Welcome to The Faithful Forebears, a podcast about faithful Christian men and women throughout history.
Episode 4.1, Roger Bacon. Half of science is asking the right questions. Roger Bacon. Welcome back. I hope that you enjoyed the short series on Christian businessmen. It was pretty different from what I usually focus on, but it was great to see people to be faithful in a new way. One thing that struck me was that all three of those men we talked about were connected to Sunday school in some way. So I think that's a great reminder that as Christians, we should never count ourselves above something like teaching Sunday school, even if we should be the founder of a multi-billion dollar company. But today we will begin another series. Our last series showed how the Christian faith formed business people into servants and blessings to their community. But today we'll be studying the connection between Christianity and science. And specifically, I wanted to show how Christianity has formed and created modern science, and how many of the best scientists in all of history were motivated by their faith in Jesus. Now, of course, today, people often pit science and Christianity against each other. You have people like Neil deGrasse Tyson or his mentor Carl Sagan, who mock faith, claiming they only use science or knowledge or fact. And you also have Christians who reject anything scientific and say that we need to walk by faith and not by sight, and that we should not be worried about science at all, worried about Scripture and living faithfully. But the history of Christianity shows that these two pursuits, faith and science, have not been at odds. Or at least they don't need to be at odds. And actually, faith in an orderly and loving God is what gives birth to a scientific understanding of nature. So to begin in this series, we're going to be going back to the Middle Ages. Back then, the word science did not mean what it means today. We might think of science as specific knowledge of the natural world and natural phenomenon, but in the Middle Ages, the word science simply meant knowledge of any sort. So no one in the Middle Ages said they studied science, and no one was called a scientist. Instead, if you wanted to study nature and how it worked, you studied natural philosophy. But for the most part, the intellectual people of the early Middle Ages did not spend too much time writing about the workings of the natural world. And to understand the natural world, many intellectual people simply relied on the works of ancient Greeks and Romans, such as Plato. Now, that doesn't mean no one ever did. For instance, one famous person who wrote quite a bit about natural philosophy was Hildegard of Bingen, and I did an episode on her way back in Season 1, Episode 9. She was very interested in things like medicine and astronomy and math. But again, there was no science, and there was no scientific method, and no system of experimentation. So today we're going to be looking at the very beginnings of those ideas. Those ideas did not just pop out of someone's head fully formed one day, but they slowly formed in many minds over centuries. So today we're going to look at someone who is a forerunner of the scientific method. Someone who first began exploring the ideas of experimentation. And someone who was convinced that natural knowledge could be used for the betterment of mankind, both in a physical and in a spiritual way. This man was named Roger Bacon. Now, before we get too much into Roger Bacon, I have to say this. Roger Bacon is not to be confused with Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon is actually the more famous of the two. Francis is often considered the founder of the scientific method, while Roger is one of the great forerunners of it. Because of this, Roger Bacon is sometimes known as Dr. Mirabilis, which means wonderful teacher. So Roger was born in England sometime around 1215, though the exact date is hard to say. And actually, there are many details of his life we don't know exactly. I will mention some of the events in his life are conjecture or merely plausible. For instance, not only do we know the exact year, we also don't know the exact city he was born in either. Roger was likely born into a wealthy, or at least not poor, family. He had enough to go to school. At age 12, he went to Oxford College. And there he learned the standards of the medieval education. The trivium, which is grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and the quadrivium, which is arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. If you remember from previous episodes in season 1, the trivium was education about words, and the quadrivium was education about numbers. Now, sometime in the 1240s, Roger made his way to Paris to study at the University of Paris, which at this point was a great center of learning in Europe. And it's likely that there he received a Master of the Arts degree. Right around the same time Roger Bacon arrived in Paris, someone else famous arrived in Paris who caused quite a stir. Well, they didn't arrive personally, but their works did. It was the Greek philosopher Aristotle. Aristotle, who had lived and written about 1,500 years before Roger Bacon, had mostly been lost to the West. No one had any copies of his work. But thanks to connection with the Islamic world, Aristotle's works began to spread in Europe again. And in fact, Roger Bacon has some of the first recorded lectures on the work of Aristotle of anyone in all of Western Europe. While he was in Paris, he was able to meet and learn from many other great scholars of his day. Several of them would have a major influence on him, with their focus on natural philosophy. One was a mathematician named Peter Peregrinus. Bacon described him this way: "Peregrinus gains knowledge of matters of nature, medicine, and alchemy through experiment, and all that is in heaven and in earth beneath, so that nothing may escape him which ought to be known, and that he may perceive how far to reprove all that is false and magical." It was likely that Peregrinus first got Roger interested in the study of nature, natural philosophy, and what we now call science. At some point, again the dates are often conjecture, probably 1248, Roger returned back to England and began lecturing in Oxford. His family was able to support him and helped him obtain books and equipment for his growing interest in experimental science. At Oxford, he was influenced by another great man of natural philosophy and experimental science, a man named Robert Grosseteste. Robert Grosseteste is famous in his own right, and some people rank him as a true forerunner of the scientific method equal to Roger Bacon. One book on Grosseteste states, "In the 13th century, the Oxford School, with Robert Grosseteste as its founder, assumes a paramount importance. The work of this school, in fact, marks the beginning of the modern tradition of experimental science." Grosseteste was one of the first to take seriously the idea of observing particular things to get the idea of the general principle, and then using the general principle to predict particular outcomes. Grosseteste called this resolution and composition. He also speculated that creation began with an explosion and that everything expanded out from it. Grosseteste also had a special interest in optics and light, a passion that would pass down to his disciple Roger Bacon. And Bacon would often say how indebted he was to Grosseteste. But around this time, Bacon was also becoming very frustrated with the medieval educational system. He saw that instead of actually putting into practice or testing the words of Plato or Aristotle, his peers were simply taking them for granted. And then, by using deduction, these academics would logically move from an idea to a conclusion, again without actually seeing the results. This frustrated Bacon, as he thought simple reasoning from experts of the past was not enough for true knowledge. Not only should someone reason their way to conclusions, but they should also observe and test them. But as these ideas were forming, disaster struck. In England, a civil war broke out between the king and some of his barons, known as the Second Baron War. And in this war, Bacon's family was caught on the wrong side, and they lost most of their wealth. Now Bacon had no more resources to continue his work. Somewhere around this time, Bacon also decided to join the Franciscan Order of Monks. The Franciscan Order was still quite new, as St. Francis himself had only died about 50 years earlier. Now, there is an argument that Roger Bacon joined the Franciscans because he needed some funding for his work. But this doesn't seem entirely plausible, because the Franciscans were known for their poverty. And later, Roger Bacon would join with a side of Franciscans committed to extreme poverty. So it might not be that Roger joined the Franciscans for their money, but because the Franciscans at the time were more open to studying the works of Aristotle than anyone else was at the time. It was at this time that he would also make a friendship that would affect the rest of his life and his legacy. The papal ambassador to England was a man named Guy Le Gros de Foucq. The friendship would have huge dividends, as this Guy Le Gros de Foucq years later would become Pope Clement IV. Years later, as Pope Clement IV, he would write to his old friend to ask him to send him a writing that summarized all that he had been learning in his study of Aristotle and nature. It was a hope for a compendium of writings and remedies for current conditions. But the Pope, talking with a messenger, had misunderstood an earlier communication from Roger, and thought that Roger Bacon had already written a work like this. But as soon as Roger Bacon heard the Pope wanted this, he immediately went to work creating something. And so he created his largest and most complete work, a document he called Opus Maius, which means in Latin, largest work. So not the most creative, but he is a scientist. In this, Bacon included many of his opinions, his views, and his philosophy of nature and of education. In fact, it's such a complete picture of his concerns and passions that we'll spend a little while going through what was contained in this work. So the first big issue Bacon confronted in his Opus Maius was the education system, which he thought needed serious reform. Now, most of the university education at the time was done by debating over works, such as the works of Augustine, or Church Fathers, or a work called Sentences by Peter Lombard, a favorite of medieval theology. But Bacon despised this, for Roger Bacon, instead of just discussing what Plato said about nature, he wanted to observe it himself. Instead of reading only what others had said about the Bible, he wanted to read it and study it himself. In fact, this was another way that Bacon was a pioneer of something to come later. He was very interested in both the Greek and the Hebrew language, because he wanted to know what the original manuscripts of Scripture said. And while he had limited access to either learning Greek or the Greek Bible, he still was able to create a basic Greek grammar and teach simple Greek. Bacon also laid out his love for mathematics in this Opus Maius. For Bacon, mathematics was the foundation of all other science. While Bacon thought mathematics had no intrinsic value of its own, he thought that it was the foundation for all other study, even theology. And so he called mathematics the gate and key to all other science. Bacon's work also included a section on the need for calendar reform. The Julian calendar, which had been in place since 46 BC, needed some serious alteration. And Roger saw that it needed to be fixed and proposed a working solution. Sadly, it didn't catch on at the time. But 300 years later, the calendar would be fixed by Pope Gregory XIII when he created the Gregorian calendar. And it followed many of the same ideas of Roger Bacon. Also, this work included some on optics. Amazingly, Roger Bacon's work on optics led to the invention of eyeglasses and telescopes. In fact, 300 years before being invented by Galileo, Bacon described a telescope this way. He said, "For we can so shape transparent bodies and arrange them in such a way with respect to our sight and objects of vision, that the rays will be reflected and bent in any direction we desire, and under any angle we wish, we may see the object near or at a distance, so we may cause the sun, moon, and stars in appearance to descend here below. Wow. Pretty much nailed it. In this work, he also included a description of gunpowder. Now, because of this, sometimes Bacon gets credit for inventing gunpowder, which is not true, but he was the first European to describe it in writing. He also had the foresight to see that it could be used as a powerful weapon. This part also included sections on alchemy, in which he was not so much interested in turning things into gold, but he was interested in discovering how things could be used as medicine, which was unique for the time. Unfortunately, this would later get him labeled as a magician by his critics, but Bacon made a clear distinction and said magic derived its power from demons, but he was interested in how things acted in accordance with their nature. And as would also get him in trouble later, he believed in astrology, that is, that stars and planets could tell you things about events on Earth. And a quick note, while we might think of that as something like magic, in the Middle Ages that was not necessarily true, and many considered it simply a way to interpret the signs of God's creation. Now, after months of tireless work on this document, Roger Bacon sent this huge book to the Pope and anxiously waited to hear a reply. He had put so much in there, and hoped that the Pope would be able to support him in more research and learning and training missionaries and possibly even help him reform the educational system. But today, as we eagerly and anxiously await for email replies, Roger Bacon got anxious and eager. And after several months, he realized that a busy Pope probably would not have enough time to read the whole tome he had just sent, so he decided to create a smaller one, which he uncreatively called Opus Minor, which means smaller work. This work was intended to be a shorter version of the longer one he'd sent earlier, basically a Reader's Digest for someone too busy for the whole thing. And he waited again. But he was still anxious and nervous, and so he decided he should send a third work as somewhat of an introduction to the other two. So this one he called Opus Tertiary, which in Latin means third work. He had lots of other gifts, so we will forgive him for his names. Sadly, several months after he had sent his first work, Opus Maius, Pope Clement died. That was in the year 1268. So we don't know if the Pope ever got to read it or not. And whether he was or not, he was never able to write a response. It was a big blow to Bacon, as there went his access and support, financially and morally. Now Bacon continued his work as best as he could, but later he would have a run-in with some of the authorities of the Franciscan order. Bacon was viewed with some suspicion because of his interests, and was starting to sometimes be accused as a wizard. In 1277, Jerome of Ascoli, an authority of the Franciscan order, condemned some of Roger Bacon's work, and possibly had him arrested or put under house arrest. This was likely not so much because of Bacon's ideas, but because Bacon had aligned with a group of Franciscans who stressed extreme poverty, and that put him at odds with some in authority. But Bacon kept writing and working till the end of his life, and I'll just mention several other contributions he made to other fields. Some of his other works included the field of semiotics. Now, if you have never heard that word before, don't worry, neither had I. It is the study of signs and symbols. Roger Bacon stressed that the meaning of words can always change because words can be used in different ways from their original purpose, sometimes even unconsciously of the people using them. But this gets into pretty deep philosophical water, so I will defer to someone who knows more what they're talking about when they describe his contributions to his field. So this is from an article by Pia and Tolik Piper from James Madison University. Moreover, Bacon's work on semiotics is notable for his insistence that things, rather than their concepts, are the principal significance of words. Together with the work of Dante Alighieri, Bacon's work on language stands out in virtue of his observations on the evolution of languages. Lastly, Bacon's linguistic work is noteworthy in virtue of his having stated the basic principle of universal grammar, that is, the principle that there is only one grammar for all languages. So even if you didn't really understand that, know that Roger Bacon did. He was a deep thinker. Now traditionally, although again there is some debate, Roger Bacon died in 1292 in England. He was an old man and had worked and studied science and philosophy for 60 years. Though ironically, after spending a whole life praising experimental science, he did very little of it himself. He did a few experiments on optics, but that was about it. So, as some scholars said, he preached a bit more than he practiced. But over the centuries, Roger Bacon's influence would grow, as people saw the validity of so many of his views, and that many of his predictions and foresights came true. When the scientific method finally was created, there was already a framework behind it thanks to Roger Bacon. He would be considered a magician or wizard by some, but a great philosopher, and eventually as a champion of modern science, by many others. But while he certainly was a fascinating character from the Middle Ages, how in the end does he actually line up between the relationship of science and faith? And does he actually show how the two can work together? Those who champion science against faith like to think that he was truly on their side and didn't really care too much about theology or God, but really just cared about science. But that's not true. Bacon's commitment to the truth of God found in Scripture led him to seek, to the best of his ability, the truth in the natural world. As mentioned before, Roger Bacon cared deeply about Scripture. This is why he wanted to know Greek and Hebrew, so that he could more closely study what it said. It was the source of his faith. And in all he did, whether theology, philosophy, or natural philosophy, Roger Bacon was interested in wisdom. Knowledge of the natural world and faith were both aspects of wisdom to Roger Bacon, which reveal God's truth in the world. But it was all secondary to the greatest truth, the truth that God wanted to reconcile all things to himself. He said, "All other sciences are called speculative. They are not concerned with the deeds of the present or the future life, affecting man's salvation or damnation. All procedures of art and of nature are directed to these moral actions and exist on account of them. They are of no account except in that they help move forward right action." So for Bacon, knowledge, science, especially experimental science, was not actually great in and of itself, but only great for the happiness and easing the suffering of mankind, improving mankind's morality and virtue, and ultimately the spread of the message of Jesus. Knowledge was an aid to wisdom, and wisdom was the path to virtue. And virtue is what God desires for his creation. Bacon said, "Virtue is the life of a human being." In fact, in his criticism of the Middle Ages, he was frustrated that these learned people were not concerned with those things, and instead were arguing how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. So Roger Bacon was both a dedicated follower of Jesus Christ and dedicated to searching for the truth about God's kingdom in nature. And he always saw the two as working together, not against each other. Science, or natural philosophy, was a way that Roger Bacon could learn more about God, and a way that he could learn more clearly how to love God and love his neighbor. So to God be the glory for his servant, Roger Bacon. Now next time, we will confusedly look at Francis Bacon. And no, Francis Bacon was not a descendant or even a relative of Roger Bacon. And yet, strangely, these two men both helped lay groundwork for so much of modern science, and were both inspired by their faith to do so. So, I hope you enjoyed this episode. And also, I hope you will enjoy this series on science. Please let me know what you think, or if there's any particular questions or ideas you want me to talk about. And if you liked it, please like and subscribe, It really does a lot for the podcast. And also, please leave a review if you can. That's even better. And since I don't currently use social media, and I don't do a whole lot of advertising, please, tell a friend. I'm Eric Klossel, and thanks for listening.